Okay, well, welcome everyone. It's always a privilege to have these talks and to be with you all today. These talks are on every Friday. So my name is Nilushi, for those of you who haven't met me. Are there some new people here tonight? It's a few new people. Okay, so I'll just give you a bit of an overview. So there's normally a guided meditation for about 20 minutes. We have a tea break and have a talk, and there's time for questions at the end. If you have any questions at any point, just come and find me. I also have an email list, so if you want to get weekly reminders or on occasions where we have guest speakers, I'm happy to send you an email. I'll just make a few quick announcements as well. Two of our community friends are printing Bhante's translations of the suttas, the early Buddhist teachings, and you can support them to donate some copies of it. They're about $300 or $350 for 28 books, and that's a set. Or you can order one for yourself. If you're interested, there's some flyers just on the table over there. And also, check out the Meta Centre website for a retreat on the 18th of April at Wanda Place with Venerable Tenzin. The monastics have been a guest speaker here as well. Thank you, Bhante, for sharing that. Also, just wanted to acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're meeting on, the Cammeraygal people, and just pay my respects to their elders. Just acknowledge their thousands of years of meeting. Finally, I'll just introduce the speaker, and also just a bit of a content warning. This is our monthly Dark Week, so once a month, Bhante explores some contemporary issues that are more challenging in nature and have ethical connotations, and he gives really interesting critical reflections from a spiritual perspective, and helps people to frame some of these, some of these sort of deeply troubling issues. So this week he'll be talking about war. So it's not our normal program, so it's a monthly challenging issues week. So just letting you know, so if you feel like you're not in the headspace for that, you're welcome to leave after the meditation. So just letting people know that, exploring difficult issues today. Finally, I just introduce the speaker. Bhante Sujato has been a monastic for 30 years. He's a very senior teacher in the region. He trained in the Thai Buddhist tradition and the Ajahn Chah's tradition, and then with the very famous Ajahn Brahm after that. And he was an abbot of Santi Forest Monastery for about 10 years. And he also he started Sutta Central. He co-founded it in 2005, which has translations of the early Buddhist teachings in contemporary English. They're free, have copyright. So it was quite a feat. He took a few years off, stayed in Ireland and focused on that project. He's published quite widely, all kinds of writing from creative fiction to scholarly work. And you can check the Lokanta website to see some of his articles, and he's got lots of talks on YouTube as well. So he's a very experienced teacher, extremely fortunate to have someone with that much experience and incredible knowledge with us on such a regular basis. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Nilushi. That's very kind. So if anybody ever needs a self-esteem boost, they can just call Nilushi and get her to give them a rundown on their life's achievements, and they'll make them feel good. So I'm just offering that public service on Nilushi's behalf. All right, so let us begin, as usual, with reciting the words of the Buddha. If anybody needs a chanting sheet, hopefully we've distributed them around to anybody who needs them.
Oh,
we've got a new freshly printed batch. Excellent. Thanks, Kat. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dvitiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dvitiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dvitiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Iti piso bhagavaraham sammasambuddho vijja charana sampando sugato lokavidu anutaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusana buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sannitiko akariko ehi pasiko opanayiko pachatam vedi pako vinyuhiti supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka sambho ujjupatipanno bhagavato sāvaka sambho nyāya patipanno bhagavato sāvaka sambho samīci patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yadidam chatari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhineyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketa lokasati. Okay, very good. So as usual, we'll begin with, I'll say a few words about meditation. We'll do some guided meditation together. Is anyone here who's never meditated? Oh, there's a few new people here. Anyone who's never meditated? Anyone? Unfortunately. So we'll have to begin by unlearning. Number one process in meditation, forget everything. The more your mind is congested with ideas about meditation, then the harder it's going to be. Which is unfortunate because we also have to talk about meditation, even write books about it or whatever. But the reality is, as somebody who has taught meditation for a long time, practiced meditation for longer, the reality is that the essence of learning how to meditate is very simple. And don't let anybody tell you otherwise. The Buddha's fundamental instruction on meditation, I'm going to run briefly through the basics of how the Buddha said to set up meditation. So the first thing is we need a place, Okay, so here we have a place we can sit together and do some meditation for a while. This place is okay for meditation. It's reasonably quiet. We're going to be reasonably undisturbed. It's not too bad. If you can find a cave in the Himalayas, good on you. You can find a cave in Sydney Harbour. Meditate there. That's pretty good as well. To meditate outdoors in nature is always the best. But otherwise, to find some place, you're going to be reasonably quiet and reasonably secluded. Number two, you're going to have to need some time to meditate. Okay, that means you have to set aside some time, right? Some people say, oh, like I meditate, I'm on the train, I'll meditate on the train. Look, fine, but it's not the same, okay? It's when you're saying that, you're telling us what your priority is, right? Your priority is not to set aside time to meditate. Meditation is a specialized practice, right? And you should set aside time to practice. Now, my recommendation for a starter practice, 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Okay, this is what I recommend as a minimum starting practice for meditation. Why 20 minutes? Because 20 minutes is long enough for your mind to become peaceful and for you to really see the benefits of meditation. You meditate for 5 minutes, it's okay, it's better than nothing. But you may or may not see anything after 5 minutes. After 20 minutes, pretty confident, you're going to see that the mind has become more peaceful. It's going to be worthwhile doing it. So that's number one. If you meditate for too long, sometimes it's not really, actually doesn't help. Like you're just falling asleep and so on. Like if you're on retreat or if your meditation's good and your mind's clear, that's great, meditate for longer. But forcing yourself to meditate for longer for the sake of it doesn't really achieve anything. Okay, so 20 minutes a day. Why 5 days a week? Because you're going to forget a day. Or you're going to not do it, and then you're going to feel bad. And then they're going to make you not want to meditate. So now you can miss out a day and then tell yourself, hey, I can even miss out another day this week and I'm still good. Okay, so 5 days a week means you can skip a day. It's all right. Okay, so 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week. If you want to do more than that, that's great. Okay, but that's a minimum starter time. So try to set a time when you're going to be undisturbed and see if you can try practicing at a few different time periods during the day and see how clear your mind is at those different times. So see if you can, you know, some people minds are clear in the morning, some people in the afternoon, some people in the evening. Find a time when your mind is going to be reasonably clear, and if you can organize to be able to meditate at that time, then that's great. Obviously, sometimes you can't do that, so you just do the best you can. Okay, so a time and a place. Next thing is you're going to have a posture to meditate. So here we're sitting on chairs. It's all right. Okay, these chairs are actually pretty good meditation chairs. So if you're looking for a meditation chair, a little bit of padding, not too much. No arms. Arms tend to hurt if you're sitting in one posture for a while. The back's okay. They don't wobble. So if you're going to use a chair for meditation, don't use like an office chair. Gives you options, right? Don't use something that's like a fold-out chair that's wobbly or something like that. Don't use like a couch. It's going to be too soft and cushy, right? So some chair like these ones is pretty good for a meditation chair. Or sit on the floor. And unfortunately, we don't have cushions for you to sit on the floor here, but you're most welcome to sit on the floor if you want. I won't go into all of that, but if you want to, I'll just say that if you want to learn to sit, if you want to sit cross-legged on the floor to meditate, obviously that's the best posture. And if you're not comfortable doing that, then go do some yoga classes and ask your yoga teacher to look at your posture, give you some feedback, and then give you some stretches and so on to be able to help you to learn to be able to sit better, all right? So that's what I would recommend if you want to develop, you know, being able to sit on the floor. Okay, so time and place and posture. Purpose, very important, okay? You have to have a clear sense of purpose when you begin to meditate. That means you don't just sort of drift along and say, oh, my buzzer says I've got to meditate now, and then I sit down and I go, and then 20 minutes later I go, what was that? Okay, you've got to have a clear idea in your mind, this is what I'm going to do. So in this meditation, we're going to be practicing mindfulness of breathing. So our initial aim is to be aware of our breath. Okay, we also have a longer term purpose, which is to be free of suffering. Yeah. Now, as well as that, we also have individual and personal purposes, right? So I'm not saying you have to, like, you know, go into a lot of detail with all of those things, but you just have to understand, oh, this is why I'm meditating. You remind yourself, what was it in my, like, what was it like before? Like, what was it that drove me to do this? I've got a reason why I wanted to start meditating. And what is that? So you remind yourself of, like, what it is, okay? So all of these things are important as preliminaries for beginning to practice. Now, for the practice we're going to start in a minute, we're going to do mindfulness of breathing, and I'm going to just say a few words about that before we begin. First thing I'm going to say is that when we're practicing mindfulness of breathing, most of the time, contemporary teachers will say something like, concentrate on your breath, all right? And I want you to know that when the Buddha talked about meditation, he never used that kind of language. What the Buddha said was, mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. Yeah. That's a literal translation. Sato satova asasati, sato pasasati. Can you hear the difference? Concentrate on the breath has got a certain flavor to it. And mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out has a different flavor to it. I'm not saying that it's wrong to say concentrate on the breath. I'm saying that it inclines you to think about meditation in a certain way. So I'm not going to go into too much detail with that, but I would note that the word concentration in English, like the main use of the word concentration, is Jimmy sitting up the back of the class messing around and the teacher says, concentrate. So it means to make yourself pay attention to something that is intrinsically boring. That's basically how we use the word concentrate. And whereas when Jimmy goes home and is playing his video games, there's some more parents here who've got more experience with this than I do. Have you ever had to tell your kids, concentrate on the video game? Is that like something that is an issue? You'll do much better if you can only concentrate on it. Has that ever come up? rarely, if ever, I'm guessing. Why? Because they're drawn to it, because it's interesting, because they like it. It engages them. So that the process of meditation is not to be able to make ourselves pay attention to something that's intrinsically boring. If you do that, if you bring that mindset to meditation, you will exhaust yourself. That can last you for a while, right? You can have that resolution, I'm going to sit through pain, I'm going to do this, and you have that. And that kind of resolution can last you for a while. But if there isn't something pulling you into the meditation, if there isn't something beautiful, if there isn't something uplifting, if there isn't something joyous, then that determination will fade and it will run out. So we have to train ourselves to be able to see meditation as something that's beautiful, something that is uplifting. And that is what the process of mindfulness of breathing does. So when we're practicing mindfulness of breathing, at the start of the meditation, what we are doing is being mindful of the breath. And that breath is purely a physical flow of air in and out. But the reality is that breath never was just a physical flow of air in and out. That's merely the surface appearance of it. The longer that we pay attention to the breath, the more that we see the hidden dimensions that have already been in it. And we see, because the breath is the principle of life. And inside that breath, we see joy. We see tranquility. We see light. We see all of those things that we're looking for. And these things begin to be reflected more and more in the mind. And so the breath transformed from being purely a physical process to being an emotional and liberating contemplation. All right, let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. Okay, so sitting quietly. Being aware of any feelings and emotions that you're bringing into the meditation. Just noting them, whether you feel excited or bored, joyful or anxious. Just be aware, oh, okay, that's how I am right now. No need to think about it or analyze it. Just be aware. Feelings are okay. And when you feel like your mind is reasonably clear and together, we can begin mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Your mind goes wandering off. Don't worry about it too much. It's just what minds do. Be aware of it. Ah, my mind's wandering. And then come back, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Keeping a soft and yet keen attention on that activity of breathing. Clearly aware but with your attention touching it so softly that you're almost drawing back from it, like slightly letting the breath come to you rather than you having to go out and poke it. Sit back and just let it come. settling down. You can feel that peace settle through your limbs. Notice that the breath has started to take on a silky quality, very smooth. It starts to feel like the breath is caressing you, like it's calming you, like the breath wants you to calm down. Let it. Let the breath calm you down. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Now we're reaching the end of the meditation. Before we finish, I want you to briefly reflect back to the start of the meditation. Ask yourself, what was my mind like? What was I thinking about? How did I feel? And what was the breath like at that point? How did that change? What kinds of things were helping my meditation? What kinds of things were hindering it? And finally, how does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? So it's always good to review like this for just a minute or two at the end of each meditation. It helps you to understand how meditation works. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings find peace. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Okay, let's have a bit of a break, grab a cup of tea, have a bit of a chat. Okay, so are we ready? Yes. We think we're ready. We have one escapee, two escapees. They'll be back. They'll be back. They'll be back. So thanks, Tun Lucia, for giving a good introduction to the concept of the Dark Week and what we're doing with this. And so if I'd like to sort of plunge right in. Last week, this is the second one that we've done. And we're looking for feedback, by the way. So one of the purposes of this is so that you can know if it's on, not come, if you don't want to come. If you do want to come, you can come. But also, so last week we talked about Jeffrey Epstein, the Epstein files, and the various kinds of moral sickness that stemmed from that whole situation, which, of course, is still ongoing. And today we're going to, I think, inevitably talk about war. And obviously this is dominating the news cycles and so on at the moment. For what it's worth, I don't really want to use these sessions to talk about whatever's in the news, but sometimes it feels like hard to avoid. So for this session, we only have a short session together, and I would like to do a few things. First thing that I'd like to do is to cover a Buddhist perspective on war and how we look at it. Second is to look I'd also like to briefly survey the wars that are happening at the moment so we know what we're talking about. I'd like to look at the Buddhist perspective. I'd like to survey the idea of a just war, particularly a just war theory, which is the main model used to think about war from a Western perspective. And finally, I'd like to think about maybe what we can do or some kind of practical responses that we can make at this point in time. All right. Okay, so very briefly, just so we know that what we're talking about, there are, of course, a number of wars raging at the moment as we speak. People are dying as we speak. Oh, and by the way, before I go on, I just want to say thank you to all of those people who wore black in honor of the Dark Week. Don't think that I didn't notice, okay? Okay, it's not mandatory, but it is appreciated. So a number of wars going on today. Obviously, we're all very much aware of the war in Iran and the whole Middle Eastern theater, which is all horrible. And there in the war in Iran, again, as everyone knows, the Americans attacked, the Israelis have attacked, everyone's attacking Iran. Iran sponsoring all of these cells around the place which are striking Israel and so on, and it's all horrible, and situations are evolving very fast. When I talked about this on Tuesday, Donald Trump had just made a threat which could only have been really understood as a veiled threat that he was going to nuke Iran, and then the next day we wake up and know there's a ceasefire, except no one's actually ceased firing. So I don't know about that. So it is a very much a dynamic situation. So anyway, this war in Iran. The other war that everyone knows about, of course, is the war in Ukraine and Russia, where Russia invaded Ukraine to fulfill its imperial ambitions, and Israel's been fighting back. But in addition to those very widely reported wars, there are a number of very underreported wars which are equally serious. In Myanmar, there is a terrible civil war. It's been going on for the last several years. And the war in Myanmar has claimed, I mean, in all of these wars, no one actually really knows how many people have been killed or what the cost of it is. I mean, this one thing to know about our information age, we were supposed to be in an age where we knew things because we've got information. But it turns out that when you put the reins of that information into the hands of the rich and powerful, that you end up knowing less than you did before. So, in fact, we don't really know how many were killed in these things. They think in the Middle Eastern theater, they estimate roughly 100,000 people dead, something like that. In Myanmar, the civil war, probably roughly similar amount. And I just briefly looked at the Wikipedia page to try to get an idea of who's actually fighting in Myanmar. There's literally like two dozen different kinds of forces that are fighting in Myanmar, in the different places. Absolute nightmare. And 100,000 or so dead and incalculable human cost, especially in obviously a very impoverished and poorly governed country to begin with. Equally bad, if not worse, is the Sudanese civil war, which I think also gets very little media coverage, am I right? Yeah, but is terrible. Estimates between 150 and 400,000 dead. Systematic use of rape as a weapon of war and systematic use of genocide, wiping out entire populations, killing tens if not hundreds of thousands of civilians deliberately. And that side, the different factions are sponsored by different Middle Eastern nations who are doing it because of their sense of justice. No, I'm only kidding. They're doing it because they want the minerals. So that's what the war in Sudan is about. So all of these are horrible, and all of them are different. And they all pose a whole variety of different challenges in terms of how we can think about it, how we can relate to it, what we can do about it. And so I want to try to explore in some way our responses to these things. First, though, let's have a look at what the Buddha said about war. Better it is than defeating 1,000 men on the battlefield to kill one man. Defeat one man yourself. Yes, win a victory over yourself is worth more than defeating 1,000 enemies in a battlefield. That's basically the Buddha's attitude to war. He did not accept the usage of war at all. He only ever criticized it. And he, every word that the Buddha said was in favor of peace. Like, it's difficult for me to quote a particular passage from the Buddha because it's like literally the whole Tripitaka, like literally everything in there. We're not in the situation some religions are in where there are both warmongering passages in our sacred scriptures and peaceful passages. We don't have any of that. It's just peaceful passages. There's nothing you can find in Buddhism that's even remotely going to be used to justify a war. The Buddha did comment about war. When the kings would go to war, he'd say tonight that they sleep poorly, or tonight, even though they won, that they're not going to be happy because of it, and various things like this. He spoke at length about the sufferings of war. Places like the Mahadukka Kanda Sutta and the agonies and uselessness of war. But the significance, I think, of war in Buddhism is perhaps has perhaps also been eluded by a lack of attention to what seems to me to be the most important Buddhist text on the reason why the Buddha went forth in the first place. What was it that spurred the Buddha on his spiritual path? So I want you to just think about this for a minute. Every single person here in this room has a reason why they're here. Something has driven you to be here, some kind of suffering, some kind of something, okay? And some kind of connection, some kind of draw brings us to the spiritual path. Now, if we follow Buddha's teaching, the teachings of Buddhism, we are likely to have heard of the story of the four divine messengers, right? When the Bodhisattva was living at home in his palace, he went out, he saw the old man, the sick man, the dead man, and then he saw a monk, and then he decided to go forth, and this whole existential crisis from seeing the nature of birth, aging, and death. Now, that story is actually not told in the suttas about the Buddha. It was attributed to him in later legends. Obviously, it's kind of, you know, metaphysically perfectly fine, right? It talks about that's obviously an important thing, but it's not, as a historical fact, taught about the Buddha in the suttas. When the Buddha himself talked about why he went forth, he gave quite a different account, and that's in a sutta called the Atadanda Sutta in the Sutta Nipata, which is almost completely ignored by the Buddhist tradition. And in the Atadanda Sutta, it says, Atadandang Bhayangwerang, that the fear arises from the taking up of arms. And he said he saw people opposed to each other. This was among Bhayamavisi. When I saw that, the fear came upon me. And I saw everywhere I looked conflict and people opposing. He said it was like watching fish flopping around in a dried up stream. Very evocative image. And then he says that everywhere people, every direction is being tossed about. Every direction is unsettled. He said people always looking for somewhere to settle. But even then, when they settle, they still fight. And so this is giving us an indication of why the Bodhisattva, why Siddhartha wanted to go forth. He saw that omnipresence and that uselessness of war. And he said, why is that? What's causing that? And he said he looked inside himself and he saw in his own heart this dart of craving. And that dart of craving is what drives everybody to do these things. And so this is why he's determined to pull out that dart. So this to me is a very interesting and it's a very realistic account of why the Buddha went forth. Remember, he was brought up in an aristocratic family. One of his duties would have been the waging of war. And he was put into that lifestyle where you have to make that choice. And so he made his choice to renounce and to go seeking an end to all of conflict. Now, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, obviously, we can make a final end of all of that through our own spiritual practice. We call that enlightenment. And we can get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion and can be completely free of that. And if that's an option, that's great. But we also live in a world where most people are notably unenlightened. And they are, in fact, driven by greed, hate, and delusion, and they still get into war. So somehow we have to live here, as the Buddha said elsewhere, to be peaceful amongst those who are violent. How do we do that? This is our challenge as Buddhist practitioners. Not easy, not easy. So in the Indian context, especially in what we would normally call Hinduism, there arose a theory of Dharma Yudha, right? Dharma Yudha, which literally we would translate as just war. And the Dharma Yudha is the main theme of the Mahabharata. So Mahabharata is the greatest, probably the greatest work of literature ever made anywhere, to be honest, but certainly the greatest epic of India, and it contains everything. And one of the main overriding themes of that is the war between the Kuras and the Pandavas, and the war that pitted even family members against each other across, looking across that field in the Kurukshetra. And the whole circumstances that brought that about and everything. So the theory, developing a theory of Dharma Yudha, of just war, is one of the important philosophical contributions of the Mahabharata. Now, we don't find that term, Dharma Yudha, anywhere in Pali. It's in the Theravadan tradition. We look through all of the Pali texts, canon commentaries, not mentioned anywhere. And as far as I'm aware, certainly in the Theravada tradition, there is no theory of just war. And I've never come across that either in the Tibetan or Chinese Buddhist traditions, but I may be incorrect there. But as far as I'm aware, there's no actual theory of just war in Buddhism, which is kind of interesting. I'll come back to that later. So the theory of just war in the Mahabharata is similar to theories of just war in other places. In fact, it goes even a lot further. And the war in Mahabharata is actually very well regulated. You have to start after sunrise and you have to finish before sunset, okay? You can't attack one soldier with many soldiers. It's got to be a fair fight. You can't attack infantry with your elephants. Come on, that wouldn't be fair, okay? So there's all these provisions in there which actually go a long way beyond what we would consider to be a just war. But the Mahabharata, being the Mahabharata, includes everything. So it also includes cases where all of those rules are broken. So there's a theory about what we're doing, but the theory is not the practice. The theory is not the reality of what happens. And this is one of the problems with the idea of a just war. So that's a brief survey of the background to that. Now I'm going to consider the notion of just war briefly. By the way, I wanted to talk about something else before I go on to that. So in Buddhism, we don't have a theory of just war as such. What do we do? Well, what we tend to do is, to be honest, what we tend to do was articulated to me by a bunch of feds with machine guns who were standing around in Sydney Airport one time when I went there. So I go to Sydney Airport, walking through it. There's a bunch of these guys with like machine guns and armor and all of this kind of crap standing in the middle of Sydney Airport, you know, like you see in uncivilized countries like the United States. We don't have that in Australia. We don't have that kind of crap here, right? So I go up to them. I say, what's going on? You know, is there been like a terrorist threat or something like that? They say, no, we're just here to keep you safe. I'm saying, oh, I don't feel safe. I feel like I'm under threat from you guys. What are you doing? You know, and he said, well, you know, your job is to stop them from getting to that point. I'm like, okay. So our purpose in Buddhism is to try to, we want to develop, say, the four Brahma Viharas, develop love, develop compassion, develop joy in others' success, develop equanimity, right? Think about the way that those relate to war as well. Imagine that we related to all sentient beings with love. Who would even be thinking of war? Imagine that we were to relate with compassion, to see all of those people who are hurt, all of those poor, the vulnerable, the women, the children, all of those people. Imagine what that would be like if we actually had compassion. Imagine what the world would be like. Imagine if we were to have joy in the celebration, in the successes of others, mudita. This is really interesting one because a lot of the times war comes from these silly little grudges and competitions and so on. What if we were to say, this country's doing really well, good on them, congratulations, you know, rather than having to bring each other down and feel like we have to compete with everyone? And what if we were to have equanimity so that we would know that if there's nothing that we can do, then it is better to do nothing. That is the wisdom of equanimity. One of the main problems that's driving war these days on a global scale is the meddling, especially by Western powers who think that somehow they get to have a say in how everybody else resolves their problems. And if we try to think of a situation where that has actually helped, I don't know. We can't solve every problem. We can admit that there are terrible things. Right? We can admit that the government of Iran is a terrible government. They killed 30,000 or more of their own citizens who were protesting, just machine gunned them down on the streets just a couple of months ago. These are terrible people running that government. But that doesn't mean that bombing them is going to do any good. So sometimes we have to have that equanimity to be ready to help when we can do something that's going to help. So there's an emotional component to war. Through meditation, we can help to develop that emotional component that's going to help us to respond in a healthier way to these kinds of conflicts. But of course, that's in terms of our own personal practice. I would love it if we could get everyone to do that meditation. Still working on that. Okay, so let me consider just war theory for a minute. So I'm going to talk very briefly about just war theory. I'm going to be covering a few topics here, so it might be a bit quick. Apologize for that. You can check out the Wikipedia page on just war theory to get a survey of it. If most of the things in there are pretty common sense and you'll be familiar with them. The just war theory is mostly a Western theory. It evolved from various Christian theologians and so on and has been developed in modern times by philosophers and ethicists. It is broadly similar to the ideologies of just war in, say, China or, as I mentioned before, India or in Islam and so on. And so around the world, we find broadly similar ideas of just war. So the modern Western theory essentially distinguishes between two basic categories. First of all, what is the causes of the war and then the conduct of the war. So considering the causes of the war, then There's the first of all, the idea that war has a just cause. Okay, so the paradigm of a just cause would be self-defense. Right? So really, the main example where the theory of just war applies out of the four wars that I just mentioned, the main example where it applies quite cleanly is in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Because there you have an obvious case where one country was invaded by another and that other country is defending themselves. So you clearly have one unjust cause and one just cause. That, in terms of that, the cause, that's pretty black and white. So that's one thing. Then there is the matter of a competent authority. So according to just war theory, is related to the geopolitical idea we have about the sovereignty of nations. So it's the idea that basically the exercise of violence is reserved, the legitimate exercise of violence is reserved to the nation state. Okay, now this is a deeply problematic thing as somebody who has sympathies with anarcho-pacifism since I was a teenager, then we're well aware that there are problematics to this. When the state arrogates to itself the right to commit violence, it will find a reason to justify committing violence. Now, at the same time, though, one can understand this. If you're looking at it sympathetically, you can say that when a state arrogates to itself the right to commit violence, what it is doing is restricting the scope of those who can commit violence by excluding non-state actors. All right. So there's a way of looking at that that says, okay, we're restricting it. We're trying to put it within some boundaries. Okay. Okay. I get that. But at the same time, it also has another problem, in that it legitimizes those who've actually been able to establish a state, particularly those who can establish a coherent and well-functioning state, usually developed nations. So they get to say, we're an actual nation with a government and a parliament, we can wage war, but you lot are just a bunch of terrorists and you don't get to wage a war. Of course, from their point of view, they're freedom fighters. And they think that they have a just cause to be able to wage war. So this idea of the having the authority to wage war is a complicated one. And I think that it can, I think that it's the valid critique of it is that its definition is formed because the philosophers who formed it belonged to developed nations. And so I think that there's very much that's a problematic one. So the just cause, the use of authority, what are the other ones? To have a probability of success. So if a war is waged where only mayhem is possible and there's no conceivable outcome, right? That's one of the factors. So again, to consider the wars that are going on at the moment. So consider the American-Israeli attack on Iran. Like, what was a positive outcome? There simply isn't a positive outcome there. Whereas, let's say, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, actually, it is possible from Russia's point of view, strictly playing Mara's advocate here, okay, it is possible from Russia's point of view to imagine a positive outcome, namely that they invade Ukraine, take it over and subjugate it to the Russian Empire. So at the very least, you can say, well, they had a clear outcome, whereas in Iran, America doesn't even have that. Okay, so clear outcome, and the other one is, and the other criteria is that it's a method of last resort, all right? It means you try diplomacy, you try trade, you try all of these kinds of things. And the cause of Iran, of course, also clearly doesn't meet that criteria because they already had the nuclear agreement in place, which Trump then tore up and then said, now we have to get rid of the nukes, so we have to evade. So clearly it isn't a last resort. I mean, that's just absurd. Everything about that is absurd, but it's clearly not a method of last resort. Now, one thing that I want to then mention as like part of that is to acknowledge the peacemakers. Often the people who are in favor of war like to say that they are defending the peace. That's why we're buying so many guns. That's why we're doing all of these things, okay? Right? But the people who really build the peace are the people who build the peace. And I'm talking about diplomats. I'm talking about lawyers. I'm talking about the guy who runs the Chinese grocery shop on the corner who orders some stuff from his relatives in Beijing and is setting up relationships. I'm talking about people who are tourists who fly somewhere and meet some locals and establish connections. I'm talking about ordinary, decent people who just do ordinary, decent things and who speak in favor of peace. And I'm also, of course, talking about us as a Dhamma and a spiritual community, that every one of us has a role in building peace. It's something that you can do in your family, in your workplace, in your environment, to stand up for peace, to have the courage. Don't buy into, if you people around you are buying into wartime rhetoric and all of these things, put a stop to it. If you can't put a stop to it, at least leave it, at least get out. Don't inflame it. So all of us have a role in advocating for peace and standing up for peace. It doesn't mean that we're going to stop it, but it does mean that we have some volition and that we have a choice in how we're going to respond to it. Okay, so these are the issues in the causes of going war, and then there's various issues in the conduct of war. Again, very briefly, one is to be able to distinguish between legitimate and non-legitimate targets of war. Typically, for example, soldiers are considered legitimate targets in war, whereas civilians are not. Okay, you sign up for an army, you know that they're going to be shooting at you, trying to kill you. Yeah, that's a legitimate target. Interesting to see the war in Iran and see especially the American reporting on that war in Iran. I just saw a little snippet, somebody criticizing that war. And Americans just, I don't know, they just don't seem to be able to help themselves. Americans said, oh, yes, there were two Americans killed and thousands of Iranians, as if these are two things which are like on an equivalent level. Well, the Iranians were like people, including schoolgirls at school, and just people going around their lives who had bombs dropped on them, whereas the Americans were, well, people who enlisted in the army to go and fight at the war. So I'm sorry if I don't want to emphasize those two deaths over the thousands who have been killed by that military. And so this is that drawing of distinction. It's cruel to draw that distinction because every soldier is a human being who deserves life and they shouldn't be in that situation. And war brutalizes and dehumanizes those who carry it out. We know this. It's terrible. But this is how the theory of just war handles that. So distinguishment, proportionality is another one. Okay. So any response in war should be proportionate to the provocation. And I cannot believe that I am about to cite George Bush Sr. in this regard, but here we go. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in, was it 92? The Iraqis invaded Kuwait, Americans allied with Kuwait, they came in, they defended Iraq, they defended Kuwait, they chased the Iraqis out, and they stopped. Now, whatever else you might think about anything else, that was a proportional response. Right? They stopped the Iraqi aggression and that was it. So this is an example of where it's possible to be proportional in war. Yeah? And you can see, of course, in the current Middle Eastern theater, for example, there's a genuine provocation. No doubt that the Iranian government has been attacking Israel, that they've been sponsoring various kinds of groups, Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis and various others who have been attacking Israel. And they, on October, what was it, October the 8th, they launched an attack, killed many people. Hamas launched an attack, killed many people. There's no doubt that there is some provocation and that some response from Israel in that regard would be proportional, right? Again, I'm not saying that it was right. I'm merely looking at this particular criteria of proportionality. And, of course, both sides have suffered casualties in that war. However, in the war with Israel and Palestine, roughly 95 to 98% of the casualties are Palestinian, and about 2 to 5% are Israeli. Right? So again, proportionality. So distinction, proportionality, necessity. Right. So that things, if you're going to strike or you're going to attack things in war, that should be military targets that are necessary for the achievement of the goals of the war, rather than simply destroying things indiscriminately. Treatment of POWs, another important principle of just war. Right? You have to look after prisoners of war. This is a good example where, like for all of these principles, in fact, that these are not just nice ideals, but these are things that have been learned through experience time and time again. If you treat prisoners humanely, you hope that your other side will treat your prisoners humanely as well, right? And so these things should help everyone. And one of the final ideas of a just war, carrying out war, is not to use odious means when doing so. So, for example, not to use mustard gas or biological weapons, not to use rape as a weapon of war, and nuclear weapons, and so on. So I would add to that, in modern times, to that list of things that are intrinsically wrong and should never be used in war, is the use of fully autonomous weapons in war. No machine should be deciding to kill a human being. So that's a very kind of brief rundown of the factors of a just war. Now, it is handy to know these things. Why? Because we constantly hear journalists and politicians and pundits and so on who are telling us this and that and arguing on one side or another. And it helps to have some criteria to be able to say, does this fulfill this or does this not? And I'm going to, in fact, do that right now. I'm going to do that in honor, maybe not in honor, in memory of the former member of Warringa on whose land we're sitting right now here in Crow's Nest, and that is Mr. Tony Abbott. And look, I'm not saying this. I met Tony Abbott once with a bunch of climate change people, and he said to us, Australia, we'd do just, you know, if there was like 1 meter sea level rise, Australia would do fine. You know, it wouldn't affect it. Okay. So don't think that I'm doing this, you know, I'm not doing this to sledge Tony Abbott or anything like that, okay? Let me rephrase that. I'm not doing this just to sledge Tony Abbott. But as is the wont of Australian former prime ministers, he kind of reappears in a zombie-like fashion every so often to make some pronouncement. And so recently he made pronouncement. And the reason for actually saying, drawing attention to this was because he actually phrased it in a nice, clear way, which gives us a good way of assessing it. Let me just see if I can find it. Okay, so Tony Abbott said, what could be a more just cause? Okay, so this is interesting. So he's specifically invoking the just cause. We just talked about just war theory. The first part of it is the just cause. So he's specifically invoking this. Remember, Tony Abbott was a Rhodes Scholar. He was also a Catholic seminarian. Right? So he knows about just war theory and so on. What could be more just cause than, number one, the US-Israeli bid to deny Iran nuclear weapons? Number one, okay? Number two, uphold freedom of navigation in the Hormuz Straits. And number three, if possible, to liberate Iran from a monstrous theocracy. All right? So Tony Abbott is specifically identifying these three causes for just war theory. Now, we just looked at what just war theory talks about. We now have the tools to be able to evaluate this and to say, well, is he right or is he not? First one, okay, to deny Iran nuclear weapons, all right? So one of the just war theory is based on the idea of the sovereignty of nations. And whether you like it or not, sovereign nations can do whatever the hell they want inside their own borders. And other nations don't really get to tell them what to do. Many nations around the world have built and own nuclear weapons. Remind me, which countries have used nuclear weapons in wartime? I think that it's not a long list. It's not a long list, okay? So United States and Russia have maybe 1,500 active nuclear weapons at the moment, which I have to say is one of the major achievements of peace negotiations in modern history. Like again, that idea that war is not just defended by arms, but is built by peacemakers and negotiators have reduced the stockpiles of nuclear weapons from 30 to 40,000 on each side during the Cold War, down to 1,500 active weapons now, which is 1,500 too many, but it is a major difference. Right? It's an existential difference. I mean, 40,000 nukes is enough to destroy life on Earth. 1,500 isn't. So that's a big difference. Okay, so America, England, Russia, China, France, Pakistan, India, Israel have nukes. I think that's it, isn't it? North Korea, thank you. And many of those nations notably being run by unhinged psychopaths. So I'm not sure how possessing a nuclear weapon is a justification for war, and if so, where would that stop? Obviously, so that's an invalid reason from the start, but it's even more invalid since, of course, Trump tore up the nuclear treaty that they already had with Iran because Obama made it and he hates Obama, so that's that. Okay, so that first reason, we're invading them to stop their nukes, is not a good reason. It's also not likely that to succeed, because if anything, all this sends a message is, well, if you had the nukes, then you wouldn't be doing this. So in the long term, it's likely to backfire. So the second one was to uphold freedom of navigation in the Hormuz Strait. I don't know who he's appealing to with this argument, but literally everybody knows that there was freedom of navigation a couple of weeks ago, and now there isn't. So how are we upholding this? I don't know. And then, if possible, to liberate Iran from a monstrous theocracy. Again, we can dislike all governments in the world, okay? I could name a few that I would get rid of were I appointed to that task, okay? But perhaps fortunately for the world, I am not appointed to that task. And so we don't get to just say, I don't like this government, therefore I'm going to invade their country. But there are many means that governments can use in those circumstances. You know, we can use diplomatic negotiation, we can use trade embargoes, we can use all kinds of things that can be done if we want to try to influence another country to improve their state of democracy or something like that. And these, I think, are legitimate ways of using state power. But just dropping a bunch of bombs on them is not legitimate or likely to succeed. And as all the reports coming from Iran come out now, that their new government is even more hardline than the one in the past. So here we can see. So thank you to Tony Abbott for articulating his reasons clearly. And like, you know, I do genuinely appreciate him for that, because a lot of the times, you know, certainly with the American messaging, it's been so incoherent and so messy that it's really impossible to say what they actually want. But he's at least giving us a set of clear reasons, and they allow us to respond to that. So this is, again, what I'm suggesting. That's just an example, but I'm suggesting that if we understand just war theory, then it gives us a better way of being able to assess these kinds of statements and to know who's coming from a genuinely moral place and who is not. Now, at the same time, I also want to criticize just war theory and say why Buddhists don't have a theory of just war and shouldn't have a theory of just war. So the first problem is the name of it. Like, if just war, it's the same as Dharma Yudha, it's the same idea. Well, the war isn't just, right? I mean, you could argue, arguably, a cause in that war might be just, right? A side in that war might be waging that war for just reasons, arguably. But the war itself is not just. So that whole idea of just war is kind of problematic. And to my mind, the sort of the underlying motivation is that once you've articulated a notion of just war, then you're giving people a checklist by which they can start finding reasons to justify their war, which is what we saw Tony Abbott was doing just now, in fact. Okay? They're starting to find a checklist of ways to justify their war. And just reading the Wikipedia page on this, it had a very nice comment about this in the context of World War One. Said when World War One was imminent, the Germans got a bunch of their top theologians to write a theological defence of the justice of the German position in World War One. And when this came out, the British immediately decided to do the same thing. So they got a bunch of their theologians, and then they wrote a response saying why the British side was justified. So this is, I think, one of the problems with the just war theory. It becomes a sleight of hand to justify war. And I don't think war itself can be just. Now, within the conduct of war, it's important to understand that within the conduct of war, there are worse things and better things. And there's certainly a moral perspective that needs to be brought to that. But I would suggest from a Buddhist point of view, rather than talking about just war, we talked about the minimization of harm. It's probably a fancier, snappier term for it, but I haven't managed to think of it. But anyway, so it's not saying that the war itself is just or not. I think it's also problematic. I think it's even problematic if you're a pacifist. Like if you're an absolute pacifist and you think that no war is justified, when you come to, what are you going to say when you're talking to a Ukrainian? I'm going to find reasons to justify my ideology of pacifism, which might be correct. I'm not saying it's wrong, but rather than empathizing with that person who's in that situation. So having these kind of positions about war, I'm not sure is really helpful. Instead, to respond with empathy and with intelligence and with care in different situations. And this is another one of the reasons why I mentioned these different cases in the war. In Myanmar is a different situation. And obviously the military government in Myanmar is horrible. And Myanmar's been under a horrible authoritarian military dictatorship since 1962. That's my entire life, more than my entire life. I mean, there's hardly anyone left alive in Myanmar who's actually experienced freedom in their country. It's shocking to think about generation after generation being brought up under these conditions. Terrible. And so how do you find a way forward? I don't know. I haven't got a clue. How do you find a way forward from that situation? They asked Ajahn Chah that one time. There was ongoing war in Korea back in the 70s. And they asked Ajahn Chah, what would you do that? And he said, Banya mai po. He said, I'm not smart enough to know. So sometimes we don't know. And same in Sudan. Like who's on the right side? Is anyone on the right side? Is there anyone worth support? I don't know. I don't know enough about that situation. I do know that people are suffering. People are dying. I know that women are going to be raped. I know that children are going to be killed. I know that in Palestine, more than 10,000, tens of thousands of bodies of children have been found, and half of them have bullet holes in the head. That means half of the children in that war were deliberately targeted by IDF snipers who picked up their gun, looked through their sights, saw a child, and aimed at the child's head and pulled the trigger. Tens of thousands of times. So I know that the people are suffering, and that the innocent and the vulnerable and the weak are going to be the ones who are suffering the more. And within any of these places, if you think about the disabled, you think about people with health issues, you think about people with mental health issues, you think about people belonging to minority groups. I mean, in Iran, for example, minority religions have been massively suppressed for a long time, Baha'is and others. How are they faring in the war? We don't even have enough information to be able to know these things. So these things are happening all the time, and they are part of the fabric of war, and they're part of that unrecognized nonsense that's going on. And I'm finally going to finish this brief surveying of war with a comment from, there's a document by Robert McNamara called The Fog of War documentary. Robert McNamara was the American Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. Excellent documentary if you get the chance to see it. So he tells an anecdote where when JFK was considering his involvement in the Vietnam War, they sent two spies, I guess, to Vietnam to gather information and to come back and report to the president. They both came and they're both in the same room, and they both gave their report. And JFK's response was, "Are you sure you two gentlemen both went to the same country?" That's the fog of war. Years later, McNamara was went to a dinner with his counterpart from Vietnamese government. They were just sitting there at like a fancy dinner and some diplomatic thing, blah, blah, blah. It's like in the 80s or whatever. War was long in their mirror. They're sitting there and they ended up arguing at the dinner table. And America's saying, we just wanted to stop the spread of communism. And the Vietnamese are saying, we just wanted to stop foreign interference in our country. And they're fighting two completely different wars because they weren't listening to each other. The fog of war. Anyway, so many, many more things that we can say about this topic, but I just wanted to finally talk about how we can respond and how we can process these things. So one of the ways, I think, or I hope, is, I think, exemplified through this meeting today. We have an opportunity to talk about it. And that opportunity is limited and circumscribed. We come to this meeting, we talk in a reasonable manner. We're not yelling at each other, right? We can agree or disagree on different points, but there's a civility to it, and there's a start and there's a finish. These things help us to manage it. You know what does not help us to manage it? Doom scrolling. Or as they say it today, just scrolling. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, we have now 24/7 news cycles. I was growing up, the news was at, we got half an hour of news once a day, good enough. Check in, how's the world going? That's good enough. Read the paper once a day. Now, constant interflow. We were not meant, cognitively, we were not meant to know this much about what the worst people in the world are doing all the time. We're just not. So it's really important that we learn to keep our own boundaries around that. Now, that's very personal. I can't give you a prescription, but I would say that with your phone usage, with your consumption of media, consumption of social media, be careful and be circumspect. Don't just subject yourself to endless horrors. I was talking to my friend Nadine Levy about this, and she was talking about, we're talking in the context of Gaza. She has a Jewish background, but she was saying, you know, a lot of her friends among the progressive Jews, the phrase that she used were their brains have been cooked by seeing so many photos of children being killed, so many images of children being killed. You don't have to subject yourself to this stuff. You don't have to traumatize yourself. If there is one thing that the people suffering in war want is for you to be happy. They don't want everyone else to suffer like they're suffering. They want to be free of their suffering. They don't want us to suffer as well. And so compassion as an understanding, and so compassion has some information. So inform yourself, all right? But don't like subject yourself. Don't become swamped. Yeah? Use one of the techniques or one of the skills to learn is to use some discernment, okay? So to not just swallow everything. Don't just put on Fox News in the background or some of this kind of crap, but just use some, just find some people who you can trust, some journalists or some writers or something like that, and listen to what they are saying. And you know, keep your information limited. You're not a general fighting the war. You know, you're not a diplomat. Well, if you are, okay, then it's different. But you're not doing that. You don't have to know every detail about the war, okay? But just keep your information limited. Listen to voices of reason. Don't listen to voices of unreason. Difficult, I know. Don't subject yourself to the algorithm, okay? Don't just get off Facebook, get off Twitter, get off these kinds of things that are just feeding you full of crap. If you want a decent news source, I recommend reading The Guardian, still probably the best generally freely available news source on the web. If you want, so limiting and circumscribing your information and making sure, you know, check in emotionally with yourself of how you're faring with it, but also checking in with the people around you, making sure that they're okay, asking them about it, and bringing that compassion. And, you know, don't let, it's okay to talk about the war, like we're talking about it here, but don't let it become the topic of every conversation. Yeah. So this is what I'm, again, what I'm trying to model through doing these talks, is there's a time to talk about it and there's a time to set it aside. Yeah. If you can't ever talk about it, then that shows that the fear of it is actually driving you. And if you can only talk about it, it shows that the fear of it is driving you. You decide when you're going to talk about it and when you're not, yeah? And how you're going to talk about it. And I would encourage you to, you know, stand up where you can and how you can for peace. And whether that is sharing memes in favor of peace on some non-toxic social media site, good luck with that. Whether it is talking to your friends, talking to your colleagues, whatever it is, but to stand up for peace and to stand up, stand against bigotry and hate. One final observation I would make before wrapping up for this evening, we've got a little bit of time for questions, but one final observation I would make is that with regards to Donald Trump, he smells blood now and he's not going to stop. He will continue to escalate until somebody stops him. So, yeah, whatever happens in Iran, who's next? Cuba, definitely. Canada, Greenland, none of these are off the table. Hopefully we can try to do better. And I would like to say that for Australia, that we can hold our government more accountable and to do better rather than going in always with America. And I think that it's obvious that this is now a policy whose time is well overdue. And that personally, my thought, and I'm not an expert in this, but I believe that medium-sized nations like Australia should be cultivating relationships with other medium-sized nations of similar sympathies, like, say, Sri Lanka, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, and building connections in our region rather than aligning ourselves with superpowers who have shown themselves to be irresponsible in how they're using their power. Okay, so that's all I have to say for now. Any questions? Or like primal screams is also okay if you just want to bellow. Yeah. Should the leaders of countries not be on the fence? Yes, I believe so. In this kind of case, the moral situation is so straightforward. And we've seen that there are countries that are taking a position, like Spain, for example, has been one of the best ones. And so good on them. I think France as well. Yeah, so some of the European countries, I think, are more clear-eyed in Australia. The liberal international order is over. And that idea that we can be guaranteed security by allying it with America is over. And Europe is realizing that. And I don't think Australia has yet. We're a bit backwards sometimes. Yeah. Yes, Barbara.
I thought it was wonderful to see the monks walking the walk from
Greece. Right.
They walk from Texas to Washington.
Walk from Texas to Washington, right?
Yeah.
A long way. That was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's right. So the Vietnamese monks walking from Texas to Washington, and that really captured people's imagination. And that's what I was meaning when I was talking about those who are building peace. You know, I mean, they're standing up, and you could see like so much sympathy and everything. I happened to run into someone at that time. She was from West Virginia, something like that. And she's like, oh yeah, the monks are going to be coming by my town sometime, you know, the next few days. She was so excited, you know. And so it is genuinely inspiring. And we know that when there are leaders who can tap into that, then they can become epoch-changing figures, you know, people like Nelson Mandela or Gandhi and so on. But rare to find, right, for some reason. Yeah. Anyway, anyone else with some questions or thoughts? Got a few comments online. I might take those comments online briefly. We do have to get out of here because the staff will have to be closing up. So Christelle said, last week she went into the forest with a lady friend, meditated for an hour. We went during the day while she was meditating. She was much less peaceful than when she meditates at home, much more aware of the noises around and more worrying thoughts. Any advice? Shall I repeat the experience? Yeah, don't worry about it, Christelle. Go and do it again. It's a bit unusual, whatever. When you're outside, there's more like energies around, right? It's more kind of activating, but actually it's good, yeah. Okay, so Joe Ter, what I can't wrap my head around is it's been centuries, right? Why can't United Nations or bigger world bodies just lock up people who declare war? Thank you. Yes, just lock them up for war crimes. So briefly to comment about that, I mentioned a little bit before about what we call the liberal world order, and this was basically a system that was built after World War II around the United Nations and various kinds of international agreements whose aim was to say, maybe let's talk about our differences rather than going to fight about them. And that has been obviously of limited success, but I think it's important not to be too cynical about what that has achieved. And I think that there are genuine long-term achievements, the creation of the EU being one of them. And, you know, how much war was being fought between European powers for such a long time. And for the last period, then that has basically stopped. So these things can work. And it is possible to create peace and to build peace, but it is a long and slow process. One thing that I would think in that case is that think about countries. There's like 150 something countries in the world. I don't know how many. And they all have governments, more or less. And how many times are those governments really bad? Like a lot, right? We're making new governments every year. We've had thousands of times at creating national governments, and we are still terrible at it. And we've had precisely two times at creating an international body, the League of Nations that failed, and then the UN. Yeah, kind of a bit of both, right? So I think it's a step in the right direction. But, of course, always UN has always been hindered by the fact that it was created in the wake of World War II. So Scott asked, did I write an essay on the Just War thing? I think I remember reading it the last 6 months. I did. I did write a thing on the Just War thing, probably. No, I think I did, yeah. One thing I was going to say about the Just War thing. Actually, I forgot to mention this. I should have mentioned it. So in Western ethical thinking follows from Aristotle and the law of the excluded middle, A or B. Indian thinking is A or B or both A and B or neither A nor B, okay? It's a little bit more kind of nuanced, right? And this is more acknowledges the fluidity of real-world situations. And the Buddha applied this in the case of ethics. So you have good deeds with good results, bright deeds with bright results, straightforward. You have dark deeds with dark results, also straightforward. But then you have the complicated case of both good and bad deeds, both bright and dark deeds with both bright and dark results, okay? But this is where it gets complicated. So if we apply this to the situation of a just war, okay, or of a war, so let's say Russia invades Ukraine, that's a bad deed. There's no justification for it. It's just evil. Ukraine wants to defend its homeland, and genuinely they know that the Russians will kill a large percentage of the population. They will take their children off to re-education camps. They will rape the women. They will destroy the culture. These are not unfounded fears. These are genuine realities from observing how Russia has behaved in the past. And so they want to fight to defend their homeland. So to defend your homeland, to defend your people and keeping your people and your culture safe, this is a good motivation. But in doing so, you're going to have to kill Russian soldiers. And killing is bad. So this is both bright and dark. And this is why soldiers, even if they're in a just cause, still get PTSD. I mean, it's still terrible because you're still killing other human beings. The Ukrainian war is very different from all of the other wars that I talked about today, because in that war, almost all of the casualties are military, a very low proportion of civilian casualties, relatively, whereas in the other wars, it's mostly civilian casualties. Russian war, by overwhelmingly the largest number of casualties is Russian soldiers. And the Russians keep pouring their soldiers into what they call, the Russian term, is the meat grinder. And more than a million and a quarter casualties now. That's like of the military age men in Russia, maybe 4%, 4 or 5%. It means if you're living in Russia, in basically your house or in the couple of houses nearby you, you've lost one young man to this war everywhere across Russia. And they just keep on going. Yeah? So that is, and those guys, according to just war theory, are legitimate targets. But they're still human beings, and they still could have had a good life and been wonderful people if they'd had that opportunity. But they're put into that situation. So, so this is why. And the fact that the black and white with black and white result, black and white comer with black and white result, that's why we have neither black nor white comer with neither black nor white result, which is practicing the Noble Eightfold Path to find freedom from all of this suffering. Because as long as we're here, we are going to be implicated in situations that require us to do both black and white deeds. This is the thing. And so this is one area where I think that the Buddhist ethical approach provides us with a better ethical framework than we get from the Western ethics. Okay. Okay, so Marion's asked another question on another topic. Marion, can you ask that another week? Because I think we don't have time for that. So somebody's recommended, Letty's recommended the Chris Hedges report for good analysis. Not familiar with that, but thanks for the recommendation. Carver said thanks. Colin says, Bhante, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. I'm sorry, you didn't put a comma there. Are you saying that Bhante power corrupts? Or Bhante, comma, power corrupts? We're awaiting clarification on that one, Colin. Thanks. Megan says, thanks, Bhante. I have so much admiration for your ability to articulate complex issues and be a voice of reason. Well, thank you very much, Sumana. Megan. Sumana also mentions Professor Robert Page is another. Robert Pape is also recommended. Thank you. Venerable Prasanna mentions that Russia is now bringing poor men from Africa to fight under false pretenses of legit jobs. Yes, that's right. They're recruiting from Africa as they recruited from North Korea before. And the accounts of the North Korean soldiers were just horrifying. They were all lied to. They were told they would be, you know, put in service positions or maintaining things. And then they just got put into the front lines and just eviscerated. And one report from one of the North Koreans said that, like, within, you know, a few minutes, Ukrainians were so good, within a few minutes all of my friends were dead. I was the only one who made it out alive. Anyway, and Leanne's, presumably Leanne's, have four continents problem solving, racial and land use. Yeah, so, yes. Okay. Look, thank you, everybody. And I'm sorry, we don't have too much time for a discussion right now, but anyway, we'll do our best. We'll be back here next week, hopefully something a little bit more uplifting. I'll try to think of some fairy tales or something to talk about next week. and we will be at Parramatta at the 5, at 6, 5 Community Centre at 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. That's in person only, so please join us there if you can. And also just letting you know that upcoming, we're going to be having a few alterations. I'll be away for the retreat in Broken Hill, and then a little bit after that I'll also be in Indonesia for a little while. So we will be arranging alternate things for here, right? So we will this group will keep going. So show up on a Friday and there will be something here. Okay, thanks. Sinsin's one with Metta Center, just to repeat, you mentioned before. Okay, so check the Metta Center website for an event with Venerable Tenzin, his one's coming down from Byron Bay, right? Yeah, in the hinterland. Not Byron Bay, Coffs, he's in the hinterland there. That's right, yeah. Anyway, so check the Metta Center website for those events and other great events. Metta Center also does a lot of other things. Okay, thanks everybody. Be happy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.